Agriculture is one of the many areas affected by climate change, and today we're going to take a look at how farming is addressing these changes. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. John Greenler, one of our guests, directs education and outreach at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. John, great to have you back.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Larry.
With us as well, Chris Kacharik, back once again. He's a professor of agronomy and environmental studies at UW-Madison. Faculty position is part of the Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative. And Chris, great to have you back as well.
Great to be back, Larry. Thank you.
So we're going to talk about climate change. Maybe as you're listening to my guest talk today, you might think about how climate change may have affected how and when you plant. If you're a farmer or just a gardener, what questions do you have about bioenergy? I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And John, we've done this in the past, but I think it's worth repeating. Tell us about the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. What do they do?
Sure. Thanks, Larry. So the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, or GLBRC, is a Department of Energy-funded project which actually engages 8 different institutions, really, in North America, so ranging from British Columbia to Oak Ridge National Lab. We're really, you know, widely dispersed, yeah. But we do have a focus here in the Midwest, and specifically 2 institutions, UW-Madison and Michigan State University, were really kind of the key institutions, with UW being the hub. Our focus, and we're now in our 10th year in this project, yeah. is really looking at next generation liquid biofuels. So how do we move beyond kind of using grain crops, using corn, for example, ethanol, and looking more at fibrous biomass, residue materials from agricultural forestry or switchgrass grown on marginal lands, and using that material to make sustainable fuels. And there's a wide range of foci that we have, from agricultural practices down to the molecular biology of how we actually utilize enzymes, for example, to break down that fibrous material and then convert it into fuels. But a very, very strong focus on the sustainability aspect, you know, from kind of cradle to grave, plow to pump. How do we look at all the pieces and put them together and make sure we're headed in the right direction? The Wisconsin Energy Institute, or WEI, is based here at UW-Madison. We're, we have a statewide engagement, and we're really looking broadly at kind of all clean, sustainable energy systems, biofuels, but also electrical power, in a wide array, nuclear, et cetera. And once again, kind of looking at how do we move towards, for example, energy systems that have significantly reduced carbon footprints, both in terms of sources, but also how do we manage the infrastructure to facilitate those kinds of fundamental changes. And, you know, it's engineering, it's science, it's also very much the social sciences as well.
Yeah, it combines everything. And Chris, you work with the Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative as well. And what do you do with them?
So, yeah, just a little bit of history. So the Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative has been folded in and made part of the Wisconsin Energy Institute more broadly. And part of my role is to assess the sustainability of choices we're making on the landscape regarding second-generation cellulosic biofuel. So trying to understand if we plant different types of crops, whether it be switchgrass, miscanthus, different types of grasses, prairie grasses, what might those decisions mean on water quality, the amount of carbon we store in our soils, the amount of biodiversity we have across the landscape. Because the feeling is we've probably got one opportunity to get this transition right. And we want to make sure that whatever decisions we make moving forward don't lead to a host of other environmental problems.
So as we look at bioenergy, as we look at climate change, let's just talk about that. How is it affecting farming here in Wisconsin,
yeah.
Chris?
So if we just back up and maybe look historically at how, you know, climate has been changing, and then talk a little bit about how that's impacted agriculture. We've generally seen an earlier arrival of spring, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, at what time are things, you know, bud burst, birds sort of arriving,
yeah.
all types of these indicators. Our winters and springs have generally been getting warmer over the last 60 years. Nighttime temperatures have been warming at a rate that's faster than our daytime highs during those time periods. And we've essentially been losing a large number of the really, really cold nights that we historically have had. And what this has meant to agriculture is we've seen an extension of the growing season by, let's say, about 2 to 3 weeks in some places of our state since 1950. So that's allowed farming to take advantage of that longer growing season, probably plant hybrids, different, you know, genotypes of corn that are better suited to take advantage of a longer season. We do know that farmers are planting their summer crops, mainly corn, about 2 weeks earlier today than they were about 40 years ago. And not all of that is attributed to changes in climate, but there still is a sort of a climate impact going on there.
I was thinking, does it work the other way? Does agriculture affect climate?
We do, yes, in many ways. The thing that probably gets discussed most is release of what we consider the greenhouse gases, so carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane. And that comes through different things that we're doing on the landscape. The CO2 releases are really attributed to things we do with tillage and disturbing the soil. And over long periods of time in the Midwest, before European settlement, there were lots of prairies and oak savannas that dotted the landscape. These undisturbed landscapes built up an enormous amount of carbon in their soils. That's a reason why we do what we do around here. They're really rich soils, and they were really good for growing food. Unfortunately, as those soils were disturbed, that tillage and busting the sod, so to speak, let's say 100, you know, some years ago, led to a release of a lot of that carbon stored as CO2. And before about 1950, land use change was really the dominant cause of the increase of CO2 in our atmosphere. And only since the end of World War II has fossil fuel emissions outpaced the land use change component. The second gas we talk a lot about is N2O or nitrous oxide, and that's really related to a transition of the nitrogen cycle in our soil plant system, where when we add a lot of inorganic fertilizers, unfortunately, a lot of that might get turned into N2O and emitted back to the atmosphere, unfortunately.
Yeah. So it works both ways.
Yes.
But
what is the
The negative effect, perhaps, of farming being affected by climate change?
So I think it in a place like Wisconsin, it puts us in a precarious position because we've got a very large gradient across our state from the south to the north in what types of things we can grow. Like corn, you grow a really short season variety really far in the north, and in the south, you're planting a much longer season variety. We have a very, what we say, a compressed gradient of things that we can do, not to mention the different types of specialty crops, fruits, vegetables in the central sands. All of these are being challenged by changes in climate. If we don't keep up and are aware of what those changes are, we may not be planting the best suited hybrids for those different climate zones. The other big change, and maybe a lot of people have been experiencing this in their own backyard, is the wide swings in weather that we have from year to year. And if you just pick on 2008, we had flooding, great catastrophic flooding in June. 4 years later, we had a catastrophic drought in 2012. That same year, we had 2 weeks of 80-degree temperatures in March. We had bud burst. We had a lot of orchards growing apples that went to blossom. Mm-hmm. And then what was likely to happen after that, killing frost and freeze, which happened, and it decimated the cherry and apple crops during that season. And even this year, what did we have? A week's worth of 60-degree weather in February, and people were starting to see, I don't know, daffodils and things starting to come up next to their homes. So that's really going to be a big challenge, you know, not just for our neck of the woods, but in any other place around the Midwest.
I was just reminded of the newscast of about 10 minutes ago when they were talking about the blossoms in Washington, D.C., blossoming much earlier, or the full blossom being over with much earlier because of the weather.
Right. Yeah. I think that February warm spell really had a significant impact on those cherry trees in D.C. You know, and it's interesting, you know, until relatively recently, we knew that these were happening more frequently, they were more severe, but we really couldn't say, oh, that's climate change. But in the past year or so, the computational power and sophistication of modeling to be able to do that has actually become available. So, for example, the researchers were able to say about a week ago that indeed that February weather that we had that was so warm for us and really, you know, much of the middle and the east part of the country was actually, in fact, due to climate change. So we're getting to a point where we can really kind of fully acknowledge that we know that these kinds of events are specifically climate change related.
Talking today with a couple of guys, Chris Kacharik, professor of agronomy and environmental studies at UW-Madison, and John Greenler directs education and outreach for the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute, visiting with them about climate change, agriculture, and bioenergy. And looking forward to hearing from you. Give us a call with your own comments, questions, or comments. How has climate change affected you or what you grow? The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I keep forgetting we have a new email. It's ideas@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post a question or comment on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Marika Suval, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll talk about more immediate climate concerns with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They'll be coming on one at a time to visit with us. That's at around 11:45. Right now, Chris Kacharik and John Greenler from the UW, our guests as we talk agriculture, climate change, and bioenergy. Call in at 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Robert in Milwaukee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Robert. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is about dimethyl ether and the feasibility and usability of this, as I understand it, a biomass-produced fuel source for engines. I know that Volvo Trucks North America is kind of hot on the trail of this topic, and if you know anything about it, I'll take my call off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. Well, what do you think? John, you want to start?
Well, you know, there's always something new out there, and I wish I could say I was on top of everything. I don't know a lot of specifics about DME, dimethyl ether, as an alternative fuel source. Have heard that it's out there, but I mean, the good news more broadly is that there are an increasing number of alternatives, that are coming on board, both in transportation and generally, both in terms of cars. We look at electrification of cars as a really good example. In the trucking industry, it's much trickier in general because we don't have the battery storage technology at this point, for example, to really have semis or planes, for that matter, that will be electric because of the just the sheer volume and weight of what it would take in terms of the batteries. So we are having to look kind of more deeply at alternative fuel sources for trucking. One that is getting is rolling out at this point in time, which I think is really interesting, is CNG, compressed natural gas. And there's a couple issues there. There's the actual technology. Can we make an engine that will handle this, and then can we find a way that we can actually store it in the vehicle? But one that I think is really interesting, which doesn't get as much play, is the whole kind of back-end infrastructural question. So we can make a vehicle that can utilize these alternative fuels, but how do we develop an infrastructural system to have the fuel at the right place in the right time? And actually, there is a lot of work going on right now kind of developing alternative fuel corridors. So especially for some of the major interstates and whatnot, that there actually would be things like, compressed natural gas stations and whatnot to facilitate our being able to, move promptly to these types of fuels. Because, yeah, diesel has a lot of problems, both in terms of being a fossil fuel, but also in terms of, you know, other pollutants. The particulates and NOx, nitrous oxide emissions, are really important to reduce as well.
So. Yeah. And some of the research is even going, if I'm not mistaken, on using our current pipeline system of gas and so forth, where we could substitute alternatives in.
Right. If we can utilize an existing infrastructural system, existing pipelines, for example, that goes a long way. And that's part of the reason why ethanol has been so successful for us, is because they can put, you know, those ethanol blends into the same pipelines to, you know, to get them regionally distributed. Where, you know, if we're looking at other types of alternative fuels, hydrogen is a really classic example. You know, it has a lot of potential, but moving hydrogen around is really problematic. We'd be starting from scratch. You know, they are developing some some corridors in California, for example, where, you know, there could be hydrogen-fueled vehicles. But, yeah, getting, you know, that we take those gas stations or fueling stations for granted. So,
absolutely. Robert, thank you so much. Bob in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I'm wondering about the 11-year solar cycle for sunspots, and it seems to be a very minimal this time around, and I wonder if that keeps up for a few more cycles, whether that'll have a short-term effect based on the weather.
Oh. Chris Kucharik?
Yeah. This is, you know, one of those naturally, you know, occurring cycles that often, you know, gets brought up about having, you know, potential impacts on our climate system. And I think, you know, we have to keep in mind that this type of variability is sort of an ongoing for a long time period. And while it might have, you know, very short term, very minimal, you know, fluctuations or impacts on our temperatures, it's really a much broader, larger signal that overwhelms a lot of times those impacts. And so it's not something that I would really talk much about in class, to be honest with you, really wouldn't have a long-term impact.
All right. Thanks again for calling, Bob. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And let's see, we turn to Tim in Heartland maybe next. Tim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. I'm calling because I love apples. And I just heard your guest say that the warm weather in February has had an impact on the cherry crop up in Door County. And I'm wondering if it's also had a bad impact on the apples we're going to see in the fall, hopefully.
Oh.
Well, just to clarify, I was talking in response to 2012 and sort of those 2 weeks in March where we had 80-degree weather that caused those plants to progress all the way to the point of blossoms coming out. I think the week of 60 degrees in February, I haven't heard of any negative impacts to this point, like a full-out bloom like maybe what happened with cherry blossoms in Washington, you know, D.C. So I would say right now things look okay, but if we were to suddenly warm up and, you know, get blossoms to come out and then we're hit with a freeze, we could end up with another year like 2012. But I'm not saying that's likely to happen. Maybe in the next hour people will answer that question.
We might get some more response from our weather guys coming up.
Yeah, but fortunately, I don't think with the apple trees, at least down here in the South, I don't think they actually, you know, there was any bud break. They weren't at a point in time where they were kind of vulnerable. So I think there's
they
a good
were okay for
okay.
now. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Tim, for calling. Rodney in McFarland, let's take you next. Hi, Rodney.
Hey, hello, Larry. I've been wondering lately, with all the modern agricultural practices of using all the herbicides and pesticides and how they kill off earthworms, etc., and compact the soil, how that may affect the climate also. Because it seems like there's so many more floods, and I look at it going, hey, the earthworms aren't there to make holes in the soil, so everything's going to run off anyway.
Huh?
And I wanted to get your guest's opinion on that.
All right. Thanks, Rodney. Chris Kucharik.
Yeah, Rodney. So I think the first thing to keep in perspective is the actual management system, the tilling of the soil, the adding of nitrogen fertilizers and that. That's probably the first direct effect on, you know, the climate system is, you know, how much of these greenhouse gases are we actually releasing through these practices. And farmers have greatly improved their management systems, you know, in the last several decades. More no-till, conservation tillage. They know how to manage their land, you know, the best that they can to improve the water-holding capacity, sort of the health of their soil. Because if they do that, they're going to end up with better yields. So, on, you know, the flip side with all the agrochemicals and that being added, there's we could spend another couple hours on a show talking about that, but I'm not too familiar with a lot of published studies on, you know, the ultimate effects on the biota from that. I don't know if, John, you want to add anything or not.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I think there are some questions out there and there's some research that's taking place, but yeah, I don't, you know, my sense at this point is we're, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done to get more knowledge there.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Al in Greenfield, your turn. Hi, Al.
Yeah, good morning. You guys mentioned ethanol, and I've always read that it takes more carbon energy, I guess, to create a gallon of ethanol than you can get out of the ethanol itself. I haven't been a big ethanol fan. I've seen what it's done, you know, just the 10%, how it reduces fuel economy and takes out in-tank fuel pumps in vehicles. I think it's been a big expense to the consumer. I'm wondering what the latest word on ethanol is.
Sure. We can comment on that. John, do you want to start?
Yeah. You know, one thing that's interesting is, you know, it's easy to think about ethanol kind of from the front end in terms of what we're putting into our vehicle. But what's really significant is where that ethanol came from in terms of the nature of the crop that was used to produce that, et cetera. So, for example, you know, looking at ethanol from corn grain is really different than looking at ethanol that we're producing from some of this fibrous or cellulosic biomass in terms of energy in versus energy out. And then just to, you know, add another dimension to that is the, like, for example, the corn grain ethanol industry and the efficiency of producing that today versus 20 years ago has just been a very large change. It's much more efficient now, you know, than it was, you know, at its inception for a wide range of different reasons. So, you know, my sense is at this point in time is we actually are getting more energy out than we're getting in terms of carbon emissions. I think there is some modest improvement. I don't think it's, you know, it's a game changer. But I think what's important in terms of the conversation we're having and here in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is moving to these next generation fuels. You know, we have the opportunity to really bring down energy inputs on some of these, you know, ethanol-based fuels even by an order of magnitude. And correspondingly, I think, you know, probably pretty close to that in terms of corresponding greenhouse gas emissions. Yeah. If we do it right, biofuels can be done right. Biofuels can, and I think in some cases have been done wrong. So,
yeah.
Move away from corn-based ethanol, then. Look at the effect on food prices. I mean, I think it's been overly expensive on the consumer, not just in, you know, at the gas pumps, but in the grocery stores too.
Yeah, once again, that whole food versus fuel concern, I think, is one that we need to look at really closely. And, you know, it's been interesting, you know, over, you know, 10 years now with GLBRC, for example, really trying to get to, you know, all those impacts, because there's a lot of, we briefly mentioned earlier, land use change. If there's more demand for corn, you know, how does that affect our agricultural landscape broadly in terms of what we're planting? It's very tricky to really parse that all out. And actually, in fact, you know, how corn versus beans, what we're growing here in the United States, actually has impacts in places like Brazil and how much deforestation might be taking place. And yeah, trying to kind of pull together all those pieces to have a good analysis is really important. It's been very difficult to do, but I think, you know, at points in times, it's clear it has had a significant effect, and we need to continue to keep an eye on that.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You mentioned Brazil, and that got me thinking worldwide. And Chris, back to you for a minute. maybe you can talk about more globally in terms of agriculture and its effect on climate or vice versa.
Yeah. Well, I think the unfortunate thing is if we think of, you know, climate change impacts globally on agriculture, is that a lot of places that have seen, you know, an increased frequency of extreme heat, droughts, are the places that are less equipped to handle and adapt to those changes. They're poor countries. They're places that have a harder time producing enough food to feed their people, and they're the ones that are suffering the most and are being, yeah, unfortunately impacted the most by those changes. And, you know, we're really looking at ways to try to help those regions out as best as we can.
And just to go back to Brazil, somebody mm-hmm. was already wondering about Brazil. What did you mean when you were talking about how that change could affect deforestation?
Sure. Well, it's complicated, is, you know, but there's a model out there, and what, you know, how we're continuing to validate it, I think, is important. But that when we grow more corn here in the United States, correspondingly, we might be pushing out, for example, some soybean production, because soybean acreage and corn acreage are pretty interchangeable. That can create a global, you know, demand for more beans that we're not meeting, more soybeans, and then correspondingly, that can be met in a distant location like Brazil, because these are global markets. And when farmers in Brazil go looking for more acreage, one potential outcome is deforestation. This has been really well documented. A parallel case in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of demand for biodiesel in Europe, for example. A portion of that comes from palm oil. The palm oil plantations are, in Indonesia, for example. We've seen a lot of deforestation there recently, which I think has been very, you know, clearly attributed to planting more palm oil plantations. So these are very complex global scale systems that we're dealing with.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you mentioned oil, palm oil. There's some other oils. Aaron has a question from Galena relating to vegetable oil, I believe. Hi, Aaron. Yeah, thanks for calling.
Hi, I'd like to know what the difference is in emissions when you use straight vegetable oil versus when you use diesel in a vehicle, because there's very little modification that needs to be made and can use a lot of the same infrastructure if you use vegetable oil as a diesel product.
All right. John Greenler, you want to handle that?
Sure. You know, I'm going to have to extrapolate a little bit here. Once again, looking at a fairly similar kind of transportation situation, there's been some really interesting recent research looking at aviation fuel, looking at jet fuel, and doing an analysis. It's very similar, looking at biofuels for the airplane industry. And one of the things they found, in addition to clearly, you know, we're flying planes on some of these advanced biofuels, we're really bringing carbon emissions down. The other thing they found is we are actually significantly reducing other types of emissions in parallel, that it can be associated with the burning of jet fuel. So I suspect that the same is probably true, in the biodiesel industry. You know, one thing I will mention that I think is really critical is we do tend to look at tailpipe emissions as being kind of the main concern. And what's really important is kind of doing a whole life cycle assessment, because especially with some of these biofuels, you know, there's really a lot of emissions which can be associated with the production of that crop, or even in some cases the actual, even further upstream production of the fertilizer that might be, you know, needed to grow that crop. Nitrogen's a really good example of that. It takes a lot of energy to produce nitrogen fertilizer. So, you know, with a crop like corn, if we're having to apply a lot of nitrogen fertilizer, that's translating to a lot of energy inputs and corresponding usually a lot of greenhouse gas emissions as well.
Interesting. Thanks, Aaron. Yeah, go ahead. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Chris, maybe you want to talk a little more about your research and maybe some of the results that we've already seen.
Sure, yeah. So some of the research that we've done previously has just been looking at trends in our corn and soybean yields through time here in Wisconsin. And generally what we found is about a third of the the variability in the trend of those yields over the last 30 or 40 years from county to county has been explained by trends in climate, basically temperatures and precip. That's a pretty big explanatory response that we can we've proved there, and as well as some of the work we've done across the Corn Belt that's looked at shifts in planting date of corn, you know, moving 10, 14 days earlier. And I'd mentioned earlier that, you know, not all of that is attributed to, you know, a trend in earlier springtime temperatures, but that farming has just gotten a lot more efficient in mm-hmm. what they can do in a single pass with their equipment, as well as some developments with polymer coatings on the seeds that they plant that are temperature activated. This allows the farmer to plant seeds in a cooler and a wetter soil environment to the point that they don't have to worry about those seeds rotting out before they go through germination. So the question, though, is, you know, are we actually going to continue to see earlier and earlier and earlier planting of crops? And I would say, well, at some point, we're not going to be planting corn and soybeans in February. At least if we are, we're in big trouble, because that means our climate has completely gone off the rails. But you start to get out of sync with sunlight and radiation coming in. And so, you know, sunlight isn't that strong in February and March, at least in our neck of the woods. So even if you were to plant a crop at that time of year, it's not getting sort of that intensity that we would get kind of in the core of our growing season.
Oh, John, you were going to add to that?
You know, I think there's a whole host of, you know, those, you know, opportunities that are out there and new developments. But yeah, we're, you know, the I think the out of sync piece is one which is really interesting as we look at these earlier springs. You know, the agroecologists, for example, are noting that, yeah, we do have, in some cases, we have, you know, earlier flowering of some things that might be related, you know, connected to temperature change. But then a lot of, for example, birds, you know, may actually be, the timing may be more corresponding to things like day length. And so we are seeing some challenges, you know, in terms of a lot of the spring rollout just not being as synced up as it used to be. And that can have a lot of far-reaching effects as well. So in terms of climate change and the impacts that we're seeing on our natural ecosystems and our agricultural landscape as well.
Crystal on Facebook has a question about the new bud growth on trees. She says, I've noticed many trees in northern Wisconsin have dead leaves still attached. Does this affect the new buds for this year? This late fall, last fall seems to have been so cold that the leaves didn't get to fall off as usual. Does this have an effect as well?
I would say that's probably pretty typical of most years. I don't think that last fall and the winter was really atypical at all. And there's certain species of trees that basically hold on to their, right, their leaves for a long period of time. So I would say there's probably not much of a concern there.
Okay. John, the GLBRC, what did you say, 10 years now?
Exactly.
Absolutely amazing to me. And you've kind of addressed this as we went along through the program, but what, in your mind, what are some of the highlights of the research that's gone on over the last 10 years?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I appreciate your bringing that up, because I think, you know, directly a lot of things we've been talking about, getting better knowledge in terms of how these agricultural systems respond in terms of greenhouse gas emissions has been really significant. I think also kind of, once again, a little bit, you know, maybe less obvious, but I think very, very important is a lot of the fundamental research that is allowing us to see ways to move forward to utilize these fibrous plant materials to make fuels, because being able to use, you know, the cellulosic materials, cellulose being the polymer that really kind of makes so much of that fibrous material, being able to utilize that is really a potential game changer. And, you know, this research is really wide ranging, from looking at, you know, advancement in terms of the enzymes to break that down to new varieties of plants which may have, you know, properties properties to make that breakdown process easier. And then correspondingly being able to take, you know, those breakdown products, the monomers coming from cellulose to sugars, for example, and being able to actually convert those into fuels has its complications. And we've really been able to, you know, make a lot of breakthroughs on that. You know, and then there's other things, you know, which are really significant thinking about the agricultural end of things. A really fascinating one is with switchgrass. Once again, it's a perennial grass, and if we can perennialize our landscape, we in a whole bunch of different ways we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions and even put carbon into the soil. But being able to get these crops to a point where they're economically viable is really mission critical. And we've had some, you know, we've had Mike Kasser, for example, on the show, who's a breeder working with switchgrass, and the potential to, you know, really get close to doubling the yield per acre, you know, with a crop like switchgrass, you know, puts us, you know, in the ballpark, so to speak, that, you know, that these crops then can be economically viable, especially on more marginal lands where it really wouldn't be appropriate to be growing corn or beans. So it's really a multifaceted suite of developments that we've had.
Somebody else wondered about, I think going back to the discussion about temperature and sunlight, someone was wondering whether temperature, which had more impact, was it temperature or sunlight on growing?
Yeah, I saw the question was related to the day length and probably the number of hours of daylight that you have. And I would say for, you know, a lot of our systems, both managed crop systems and natural systems, temperature is, you know, very important through the early, middle, and sort of early, late stages of the season. And then once we get closer to fall, then some of these plants are very sensitive to what we call photoperiod, basically the, you know, number of hours of daylight. Soybeans are very photoperiod sensitive, and they'll start to basically, that'll help trigger some of the phenological senescence, as we call it, sort of the changing of the color of the leaves as they lose that chlorophyll and start to go into a dormancy, basically. So it's important at certain, more important at certain times of the year.
Just to, we've had some questions about sort of the social side of things, the social science side of things, I guess I should say, terminology, climate change, and how people view those things. And I know there's been some research on that just recently.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important that we look at all dimensions of that. One area of study which I think has been really interesting in GOBRC is actually looking at farmers' relationship with the land. I mean, clearly these are very astute business people that, you know, are looking in markets, but they also, you know, have a frequently a multi-generational kind of relationship with land and place, and they might be, you know, looking at, you know, the opportunities to hunt on their land or just the aesthetic of the different types of crops that they can grow. And really for us to be fully aware of all those different dimensions of how we relate to the land and relate to place and be able to incorporate that into our planning as we move forward, I think is going to be really important.
Very cool. Well, guys, it's been a lot of fun. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. We'll talk some more about agriculture and its effect and vice versa on climate change.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Chris Kaczerik is a professor of agronomy and environmental studies at UW-Madison. John Greenler directs education and outreach at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And you know what? We're going to kind of, weather's been on our minds a little bit here as we talked about agriculture and climate and weather. Coming up, our weather guys, at least one of them will be back next. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW, our guest coming up next here on the Ideas Network.